Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes. James Kunin worked at Time Warner for 2 decades, and then he got fired. It's something a lot of people have had to deal with recently. The thing is that it was only after losing his job that he discovered how to make a life instead of just making a living. He shared the process in a book for Lions Press called Diary of a Company Man, and I'm very pleased that James Kunin could be here with us today to talk about his experiences and insights. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
You lost your job 4 years ago. Does it still rankle?
It certainly does. You may be thinking of the place in the book where I say I wouldn't pee on Time Warner if the building were on fire. And, of course, the building wasn't on fire. That was just me burning my bridges. But, it's the way they lay people off.
But they laid you and 500 other people
500
off,
other
so
people.
You couldn't take it personally.
Well, I couldn't take it as a group either. You know, the thing is that when they shut my computer down, took my ID away, and told me I couldn't come into the building anymore, I took that personally, because it doesn't have to be that way.
How much time did they give you to do that?
Well, as it turned out, I had about 10 minutes to shut down my computer. Now,
and then you couldn't get into it again?
That's right. And it doesn't have to be that way. In Germany, by law, you give people a minimum of 4 weeks, up to 7 months. I just got a call the other day from a woman who was the office manager where I worked, and she'd been there for 20 years, and she came in one morning, and they told her, get your stuff together and clear out. And I told her, you didn't do anything wrong. They treat you like a criminal, but you didn't do anything wrong.
But is this not typical, or is it?
Oh, of course. It's completely typical. Everyone remembers those pictures of the people carrying their cardboard boxes out of Lehman Brothers. It's become the new normal. But just because it's normal, it doesn't mean it's acceptable. It's not.
And I'm sure you didn't feel any better when your boss said, you can feel pissed if you want to.
If I knew you were going to say that, I would have said I wouldn't piss on Time Warner.
Well, you already said that.
Yeah, okay.
What did you do as director of corporate communications?
My job was – well, I should say a director of corporate communications. But my job was to try to make the employees feel that they belonged to a we. We being the proud employees of Time Warner, and we are all in this together.
So there's a certain irony in all of this.
Yeah, because that turned out not to be true. I mean, they laid off 500 people in one day, including myself, and then the next day, the CEO told financial analysts, we have eliminated the bloat. Now, so who's we and who's the bloat? That tells you all you need to know.
Well, it is also interesting that you were there to pop up or prop up morale, you'd come a long way. You'd start off as a radical in the 60s, hadn't you?
Yeah, one time.
You said at that time work seemed like a kind of death.
Yeah, I used to think that if you didn't put a necktie on, you could live forever. But it turns out I was wrong. You get old whether you wear a necktie or not. But it's true that working in Time Warner Corporate Communications is not something I planned. And my boss one day said to me, did you ever in your wildest dreams think that you would be an apologist for the ruling class?
Well, you had also had to maintain employee morale when the company merged with AOL, and there were lots of layoffs then as well.
Yeah. Really, my job was to try to give, ironically, to have people feel like they were leading meaningful lives. And I was trying to make meaning for my life. If I could, winding things back, the way what really led to my being in corporate communications was that I saw an article in the New York Times about the opening or the completion of Water Tunnel Number 3 in Manhattan. It was 800 feet below Park Avenue, a huge construction project, and a woman whose father was one of the men who died digging that tunnel was quoted in the paper saying, without water, nothing matters. And that was a revelation to me. It means that you make meaning. All the meaning that exists, without water, there's no life. Without life, there's no meaning. We make our own meaning. So that's what I've been trying to do ever since. That's what the book does.
Well, you've had a number of different experiences, and you've written books about each of them. We'll get to that in a moment. But your wife had lost her job at Time Incorporated not long before you lost yours, and she'd been there 17 years. That must have made your experience even worse. I'm sure it didn't make her any happier.
Right. Well, but on the other hand, you know, you're absolutely right. We weren't happy about that. But it gave us an opportunity, sort of last call to find your calling. And she has become a social worker. And I now teach English to immigrants. I'm very happy doing that.
Well, you've developed a knack for reinventing yourself over the course of your life. You wrote a book, The Strawberry Statement, about the student uprisings at Columbia when you were just 19 years old.
Right.
That must have been pretty exciting for you, especially when you sold it to be made into a film, which won the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival in 1970. So did you think that's what you'd be doing from then on?
I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I became a criminal defense attorney for a while. The thing is that...
And you gave that up? Why?
It wasn't my calling. I'm not scrappy enough. I'm not combative enough. And I also didn't really feel myself arguing for one side of a story rather than trying to dig up and present the whole story.
And you wrote another book based on that. How can you defend those people?
Right.
People were asking you that because you were defending... awful people.
Well, and some not so awful people, but the people that they perceived to be awful because they were accused of crimes in the street. They didn't have anywhere better to commit the crimes.
But since you were writing, I assume that you thought that journalism might be the best way to go, and you became a journalist for a while.
For a while, and then I guess, you know, I was telling you about that water tunnel story. I pitched that as a story for People magazine while I was working there. My editor didn't like it at all, and I said, well, it's not exactly Courtney Cox getting engaged. And everybody laughed, and the editor felt that they were laughing at her. And at that point, my job at People was spiraling down quickly, and I grabbed a rope and went over to corporate communications, the last place I'd ever think I would be.
Well, after you were fired, did you feel a kind of release because you were leaving the corporate world?
I was unhappy, okay? It was not a happy day. But I did feel like the Beatles sing, oh, that magic feeling, nowhere to go. Now's the opportunity to try to find my calling. I had interviewed, while at Time Warner, a man who drew maps at MapQuest, which was one of our many, many companies. And he told me that when he was 5 years old, he stumbled into a box of National Geographics, opened one up, saw a map, and never looked back. So that's what it feels like to have a calling. But for me, I felt like this is not what I'm supposed to be doing.
But had you found meaning in your job at Time Warner?
Well, as I say, I think that you make meaning. I made meaning by just giving myself the role of the person who had not drunk the Kool-Aid and who's speaking ironically a little bit about the company and also giving recognition to the what we in HR call the worker bees. I spent time with people in the call center, with guys putting in cable systems in people's houses. That was something meaningful to me, but in the end, it wasn't that meaningful to the corporation.
By not drinking the Kool-Aid, do you feel that finding meaning in work is something of a metaphorical way of trying to escape death?
Absolutely. I think that writing the book was an act of desperation. Just about everything I do is an act of desperation. It's my desperate attempt to make some meaning that I think might somehow transcend death. But people don't seem to talk about death very much, but except on your program today. But it's very much a flail that drives me forward.
You may be one of those people who's experienced a layoff, just like James Cunin, and we're learning how he went about reinventing his life afterward. He's written about his experience in a book called Diary of a Company Man, which is published by Lyons Press. Did you at least get a decent severance package?
Yes, I did. But it didn't.
So that helps.
It absolutely helps. Listen, I am not a poster child for people who have been totally screwed over by the system here. And I've talked to a lot of people who have been. So I don't hold myself out as that. I'm talking about the fact that when you're downsized, don't say you've been downsized. Say the company's been downsized. This is your chance to stand up and be truly you.
Yeah, but you can't help but take it personally. And on top of it all, you weren't a kid anymore, so it's harder to go out and get another job and reinvent yourself as you had in the past.
Right. Well, there are 2 million people over 55 and who are unemployed right now, an average of more than 52 weeks each. And if they can, this is an opportunity to find something to do that – where it's you feel like yourself. I was teaching, when I started teaching immigrants, I loved it.
But you teach ESL?
ESL. I loved it, but I'd come out on the sidewalk afterwards and I'd think, you know, this is so small. This is so insignificant. And a friend of mine said to me, well, wait, if you love while you're teaching, and but you'd feel bad on the sidewalk, what you have to fix is not the teaching part, but the sidewalk part. You have to change your sidewalk attitude. So that's what those of us over 55, we're probably not going to get the same level, same status job we had before. So
and not make as much money.
Oh, that goes without saying. And but you know, money is a symbol of value. So when you're well paid, you feel valuable. But that only goes just so far, and that ultimately probably can't serve you for your true measure of value to yourself.
Did you stay in touch with some of the other people from Time Warner? Because when people leave a job, they always say, hey, we'll get together later, and then more often than not, they never see each other again.
Yeah, well, actually, I have kept in touch with a few people. We were maybe we recognized each other at the time as being you know, square pegs in round holes, so we stuck together.
This book is written in a diary form. Did you write it as you actually experienced it?
I always keep a diary. But then putting this diary into shape to be published involves a lot of heavy lifting.
Now, I know you're no expert on this. You're only expert on your own life. But do you have any advice for other people who've been cut loose from a job?
Yes. I think that, first of all, you realize that you've probably been insulted on the way out the door. You've been degraded and demeaned. You've lost your status. You've lost your title. You've lost your pay. So you probably feel smaller and diminished. But you haven't been downsized. The company's been downsized. So this is an opportunity, if you're fortunate enough to be not losing your home and not losing your life through lack of insurance. If you're fortunate enough to be able to downscale yourself but move forward, now you can do something that means something to you.
Well, given your background, starting as a student radical and then being in and out of the corporate world, what do you make of Occupy Wall Street?
I think that Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party are both in part reactions, one from the left, the other from the right, to the overreaching of corporate power in the United States. It's, you know, people – Romney said corporations are people. You know, they used to be. In the era of the company man, you went to work for a company and it took care of you. You got your pension, your medical care. Now employees are viewed as cost inputs, period, end of story, and they're thrown out the door and under the bus.
Well, you have written this memoir. I suspect you'll be doing some more writing, and you're teaching English as a second language.
So, at LaGuardia.
Are you happy?
I am, because I'm doing something significant, and I enjoy it, and I'm appreciated.
James S. Kunin, K-U-N-E-N, his book, Diary of a Company Man, Losing a Job, Finding a Life. It is published by Lions Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, journalist Ahmed Rashid discusses the possibilities and the hazards of American disengagement with Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then writer-director Kenneth Lonergan and actress J. Smith Cameron tell us about their latest film, Margaret. A History of the World in 100 Objects takes a look at a lintel from the doorway of a Mayan temple. Also, the young Russian author Elisa Ganeva on her award-winning story, Salam Dalgat, which she wrote under a male pseudonym. Plus, we'll take a look at the Freedom Riders campaign in the South during the 1960s with an activist, Dr. Bernard Lafayette Jr., and Gerald Stern, former civil rights lawyer. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan's the executive producer, and we had help today from Keith Karn. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.